This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, happy Friday. It's great to have your company for The Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. I'm Cassie Hoff. The National Farmer Wellbeing Report released some alarming statistics this week about the rate of farmers experiencing thoughts of self-harm and suicide. But while male farmers have been the focus of mental health efforts in recent years, does there need to be a bit more of a look at how farming women feel?
Getting that social support and connecting, whether it is with friends or formal supports, is actually quite hard because we're either working on farm or working off farm in a job that doesn't allow us to make phone calls while we're working, or we're juggling kids, all which makes it pretty hard to pick up the phone and speak to someone. So what I've heard is that women are actually feeling pretty isolated and alone a lot of the time.
I'll have more of a look at that. And if this story raises issues for you, there is Lifeline on 13 11 14 and there are other mental health supports out there as well. So just a warning, that story is coming up soon. Also, the University of Adelaide Students and Ag Institute have released the Student Compendium, and it's a one-stop shop to connect students with industry, and it's hoping it will address the worker shortage that the industry is facing at the moment. I'll have more on that soon. But first up today, earlier this month, I went along to the first shedding sheep sale at Lamoureux, and yesterday the inaugural Crystal Brook shedding sheep sale was held. This time it was run by CIAA, Combined Independent Agents Association, and Nutrien Ag Solutions. Mark Tierley, the general manager of CIAA, believes with significant and rapid growth in the west, north and pastoral districts, especially with shedding sheep, so sheep that the wool falls off rather than needing to be shorn off, it was an ideal location to hold the event. And he said the day went above his expectations.
We felt that having a dedicated sale yard to shedding sheep would give the opportunity to have a market that gave structure to producers, knowing that there's an ongoing regular market for their marketing. Buyers could come and have good volumes of stock well presented, and put some certainty around the industry that we've got an interface between buyers and sellers at a yard purpose used now for the shedding sheep industry.
What was happening prior to this, and why has it just started?
The yards haven't been used since probably 2019. And, you know, it's a combination of factors with COVID and a number of other things. And, you know, the change to some of the channels of marketing, a lot more direct marketing now. And sale yards, you know, have got their place, but, you know, there's multiple channels to market now. So this facility was sitting unutilised, hadn't been restarted since COVID. And so strategically, there's been a massive growth in shedding sheep industry. And geographically, it's centred around Crystal Brook, so it's a tremendous hinterland to that growth in the industry, be it the northern part of the Eyre Peninsula, the pastoral country, but, you know, also where there's natural growth in other parts of the state. We have buyers here today from Robe and Keith and Bordertown. So, you know, there's other parts of the state come into play, but this is where probably the centre of the growth and logistically the most central.
And speaking of that growth, what patterns have you seen? Obviously, you've just mentioned about Crystal Brook being an area where shedding sheep are quite popular. What else have you seen in terms of popularity, trends and location?
Well, when I say Crystal Brook, it's pretty central to where that growth is. So, you know, the growth's coming on the northern Eyre Peninsula, far, you know, Sojourner and west. It's coming from the pastoral country. It's still coming from the south and the Adelaide Hills, but the big growth is where there's been a move towards shedding sheep, a little bit more dramatic than probably people would have anticipated 10 years ago, and away from the pure sort of wool type sheep. So a move to the shedding sheep in the areas that's hinterland here just made this an ideal opportunity.
And speaking about that interest in shedding sheep, just how strong is it and how quickly did that come about?
Look, it's built up over time, and, you know, we believe this is a long play. It's not just a here and now for the next year. And part of the idea is to build that certainty for the organised market. But, you know, we see this as a trend that will continue to keep going, and certainly the producers continue to tell us in all areas of the state, but in certainly the areas hinterland are here, that this is going to be something that I'll continue to look at.
How do you feel about the turnout here today, especially being the first?
Oh, we're really pleased. It was, a really good mix of commercial buyers, processors, restockers, people looking for breeding sheep. Yeah, I haven't done a count on the numbers, but it's been 80-odd 100 cars here and, a lot of people. So I think a really wide representation of businesses and producers. So, we couldn't be happier.
And as you just mentioned, that you're hoping to do this more frequently. Do you feel that there's space to one day merge with other sale yards to create a statewide sale?
Look, I think the strength of this facility is we can dedicate it purely to shedding sheep, and you can't do that everywhere. So we will do the first three sales, see how we're going, finding numbers. I guess the feeling is, we have Nutrien and the CIAA group of independent agents currently as the parties with the sale. And, from what we saw today, probably indicates, if we get natural growth that, these yards will be really well suited to a strong, solid, regular number. And, let's just get that bedded down and see how it goes. But I think, the Nutrien guys done a great job presenting their stock and the CIAA guys did a great job presenting their stock. And I think it's just really encouraged for everyone and people in industry that have a general view and appreciation for shedding sheep. I think we'll be happy to see this dedicated market to the industry.
Mark Tierley, General Manager of CIAA, speaking with Dimitri Panagiotaris. The nation's peak body for farmers is calling for urgent government action following the release of a report on farmer mental health. The National Farmer Wellbeing Report has found that nearly half of more than 1,300 farmers surveyed had thoughts of self-harm or suicide, while 30% have actually attempted self-harm or suicide. These numbers are quite large, and the report, which was commissioned by Dairy Cooperative Norco in partnership with the National Farmers Federation, revealed that 45% of farmers feel depressed, with almost two-thirds experiencing anxiety in recent years. South Australian farmer and psychologist Stephanie Schmidt said she was not surprised by the report's findings, but it suggests it would have been good to highlight even more that female farmers are struggling as much as men. And she's speaking here with Brooke Neindorf about what she took away from it.
I think firstly it highlighted really what many of us know and have known anecdotally, that mental health, but also just kind of farmers in general, are struggling. And if I looked at it a little bit more, and also a lot of the articles coming out, I had a lot of mixed feelings actually, in that it's the awareness it's raised around the challenge for farmers is really important, but I kind of have had a couple of reactions to it, in that it has almost reinforced a lot of this idea of like the hopelessness of farming, or that we can't necessarily do anything. And I don't think that's the case. I think that stress is visible in farming, but there are things that we can do to manage. And the other side, I think, that's really stung out to me in the way the report has been written, but also in the way it's kind of come out in the media, is there is still a constant focus on men's mental health, male farmers' mental health, and that for me, my personal feeling and kind of gut reaction, but also this is being reflected in with some other women that I've talked to, is that they're still feeling invisible as female farmers. Even though the stats in the report were actually saying that more females than men having experienced symptoms of depression, anxiety, something like I think over 30% of, or closer to 35% of females have reported increased mental health decline in recent years. So to me, the data suggests that female farmer mental health is a big challenge. But it was quite downplayed in the report of a comment saying that women find it easier to reach out and get help. And I'm like, I don't know if the data's actually there that supports that that's the case, or that's just a stereotype that we have.
Do you think it is that stereotype of more focused on the men, because in the past it has been about men not wanting to talk about their mental health, whereas now they are?
Yeah, I think that's a combination of a few things. Like, yes, the stats on male suicide, completed suicides, are still much higher than women. Often that comes down to the means suicide are more likely to be fatal. when you look at in this report, it was actually pretty close between male and females of if they'd had thoughts of self-harm or suicide. And then I think, yeah, there's been a stereotype for a long time that men don't talk about their feelings, men don't reach out for support, but women do reach out for support and women do reach out and get support when they need it. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think there's been a big increase in awareness over recent years in men recognising their mental health. But I think even aside from mental health, just through the structure of, and this is probably my personal experience, but again, shared by others I've talked to, the day-to-day lived experience of men means it's much easier for them to connect with their mates and have a chat over the phone, or whether they're connecting via Twitter or to go to footy training and catch up with their mates. But for women, what I've experienced and also heard anecdotally, is that getting that social support and connecting, whether it is with friends or formal supports, is actually quite hard because we're either working on farm or working off farm in a job that doesn't allow us to make phone calls while we're working, or we're juggling kids, all which makes it pretty hard to pick up the phone and speak to someone. So what I've heard is that women are actually feeling pretty isolated and alone a lot of the time.
What can be done to try and support those female farmers?
I think what I have really seen is there's this need for male and female farmers to emphasise that there's things that we can all do every day, whether we're at a point where we're experiencing depression and anxiety, or if we're just experiencing the everyday stress of farm life. We can put in place little skills, improve our ability to be more flexible with the challenges that come up and be adaptable, as well as kind of identifying and pulling back to our values. And so what I've seen and what I'm building for female farmers is a space and a way to create that connection, but also create that learning and accountability to do those things that help us look after our mental health. Because I think probably as women, but also even as men, we know the things that we should be doing. We know we should exercise, or we know we should get to sleep, but we fall off the wagon or we get pulled away from what we need to do. So I've developed the Navigate for Her community, which is a space for rural women to come together to learn some of these skills that help us to stay on track, but also to connect with each other and with other women and kind of overcome that feeling of isolation that we often feel.
Stephanie Schmidt, on the same day that this report came out and the media reports came out about farmer mental health and a rise in those that have got mental health issues, there was also the story about South Australia having a record grain crop. How do you think outside people would see what's happening in the farming industry when you've got two stories that are sort of on opposite ends of the scale? What do you think they're looking at when you see that, and what can that do for farmers' mental health?
I think that's such an interesting question, in that we kind of equate successful years, having good crops, high income, meaning that we shouldn't be experiencing any mental health stress or mental health issues or stress, when that's not always the case. And I think, again, there's been these stories that our mental health is worse because of the natural disasters and the impact of drought, which can, I guess, perpetuate and make the stresses worse. But I think people outside of farming don't always understand the everyday stress which can be involved with farming as well. And then behind all of that, I think particularly at the moment, there might not be current natural disasters going, but there's all of those external factors of the increasing interest rate rises and the increasing input costs and all of those challenges that we know about when we're living it day to day, and even a lot of the challenges that everyone's experiencing of challenges in workforce and labour shortages or just the cost of living. But in farming, a lot of that is on a bigger scale, and then what ends up happening is more and more of that pressure falls back onto the individual farmer, the husband and wife team, or the kind of owning the farming business.
Former South Australian Rural Woman of the Year, farmer and psychologist Stephanie Schmidt, speaking with Brooke Neindorf. If this story has raised any issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. You can also read more on the mental health report online at abc.net.au/rural. It's coming up to 20 past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, are you desperate for new workers in your ag business, or perhaps you're a student looking for work after a university course or perhaps a trade course? The University of Adelaide Agriculture Students Association and the Ag Institute have released their 2023 Student Compendium. It pulls together all the scholarship, graduate program, training and career opportunities they have been able to find in the primary production sector. Emily Chambers is the project officer for the compendium this year and the president of the University of Adelaide Ag Students Association. She says the aim is for it to be a one-stop shop for employers who are looking for workers in the ag industry.
I came from a city background, and so I didn't have the agricultural connections that I felt that all my peers had, and I knew that it was important to get that foot in the door and get that experience through university. So I went looking for the compendium and found it in my first year, loved it, it was very useful, and then just wanted to get involved as an intern and actually be the one that collates it all.
One thing that struck me in the launch of this is just how much of a team effort it is. Why is that important to it?
It's important because team is so important in the agricultural industry. The collaboration is necessary for students to get out in the industry. There needs to be the interest from industry professionals and agribusinesses, and there also needs to be that really keenness from the students coming in. So collaboration is key to all.
Well, has the drive for this come from the students or from industry?
I think that the drive has come from students and industry. I think that students are really keen to develop the skills that they need as, you know, career-ready graduates. But I think that, likewise, industry also recognise the importance of the next generation. They want a succession plan in place to be able to carry on the great work that they're doing and to really promote the prosperity of the industry.
It's organised by students with the Ag Institute, and one thing that was really focused on with this publication was the level of professionalism that you're really trying to bring to it. Why was that important?
It's important for the image of the compendium. We're trying to get really good traction at a state level and then even further a national level. It's important that even though we're students, we're viewed as early career professionals from the very start, and the way that we've been treated in our working group by our leaders Bruce and Craig has been excellent in treating us like those early career professionals that we are. It's just important that it translates into the image that we're projecting out into the industry as well.
And from working on this, have you seen jobs or opportunities that you didn't realise were available that you're pretty keen to take up?
Oh, absolutely. I have really, you know, done well out of the compendium. I get to see all the entries that come through, which is really cool. Get to know what's out there. But yeah, I myself have lined up scholarships and internships and graduate jobs straight from it, which is really cool. But yeah, I think it even showed me just what's out there, even beyond just, say, broadacre agronomy. Like, there's more out there than just those simple things that you think of when you went into university.
Emily Chambers, Project Officer for the 2023 Student Compendium. The students worked in conjunction with the Ag Institute to make this a really professional resource. It's the third year the compendium has been created. Bruce Hancock from the Ag Institute can explain how it's grown.
Dramatically. It started as a collection of just 100 opportunities for students, and by engaging students in the development of it, last year there was 150 opportunities, and this year 230 opportunities for students to connect to industry and vice versa, industry to connect with the students.
Now that you've got a couple of years on the board, what sort of outcomes have you seen in terms of the students really connecting and perhaps getting, if not opportunities, jobs?
Yes, so they definitely find opportunities for work experience. As Bachelor of Ag Science students and Animal Science students, they've actually got to clock up 450 hours of fully fledged work, and that comes in the form of jobs, internships and graduate-type programs as well. And the compendium allows them to get a diversity of those, and the students are telling us that it actually opens their eyes up to other opportunities that they weren't aware of before they actually had a hunt through the compendium.
And how has industry received it as well? We hear a lot about the demand for workers in rural industries and across the spectrum of jobs as well. How well has it been received?
Yeah, well received, because the industry were waiting at the end of the education pipeline to attract the students, a lot of them have actually got jobs before they actually get their degree. And so it's a calling card or an entry mechanism to reach into the students while they're still studying, give them that work experience and give them offers to actually work in their business. Going forward, we will continue to support the Adelaide University Agriculture Students Association in their professional development program. Like they are unique to Australia in being a student club or an association. They do more than just social activities. They actually run their own professional development program and have four or five events, quality events, throughout the year, culminating in Growing the Future, which is hosted at the Adelaide Oval, you know, South Australia's pristine conferencing event. Where over, you know, nearly 300 people come to that event in August.
Bruce Hancock from the Ag Institute speaking there. If you're keen to take up those opportunities, get your hands on the 2023 Student Compendium. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Vince Rollins has the latest in weather. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
What's happening on the
track? Look, not a huge amount at the moment. So we're still seeing a little bit of shower activity about parts of the agricultural area. So we had a bit around in the 24 hours up to 9 a.m. this morning. Generally less than a couple of millimetres, a few places. Got a little bit more about the Mount Lofty ranges and around the southeast, but still got a little bit happening at the moment. Again, generally less than a couple of millimetres. But we are in a bit of an easing trend for those showers in the south. So tomorrow, probably likely to see just some showers about Windward Coast and ranges and a bit of a south to southeasterly airstream. And then basically clearing from the south as we head into Sunday. But a bit of activity still expected up in the northwest of the state, so we've got an upper system moving through there, so likely to see some rainfall through the north of the northwest pastoral district today and continuing tomorrow. And then really just easing back quite a bit and contracting to the far northeast and continuing right through until around Monday, Tuesday. And could see a little bit of thunderstorm activity up through that region as well. So, yeah, generally into an easing trend right across the state as we head across the weekend into early next week. But as we get into the sort of middle of next week, we do see a low-pressure system developing about the Bight region and then developing a bit further as we head later into the weekend, moving across the south of the state. So that one's quite interesting because it looks like it's going to bring quite a bit of rainfall with it, starting over western parts on Wednesday, maybe just reaching some central districts sort of late on Wednesday, but then continuing over the south of the state during Thursday, Friday, and continuing into, another secondary system comes through as we head into the Easter long weekend, and that's just going to continue those showers in the south probably right through the Easter weekend. So, looking pretty wet as we head into sort of middle to late next week, but elsewhere before we get there, as I mentioned, going into a bit of an easing trend. The temperatures, sort of remaining below average for this time of year over the next few days, although we should see a little bit of warming starting from Sunday and continuing through the early parts of next week ahead of that system that does come through the middle of the week, and then of course that will bring cooler conditions. So looking like a little bit of activity around for the next couple of days in the far north and about coast, but generally looking at not too bad the latter part of the weekend and early next week. So rainfall totals, this is just for the next 4 days, so generally looking at around maybe less than a couple of millimetres about the agricultural area, around 5 to 15 millimetres in the north of the northwest pastoral, maybe seeing some totals a little bit higher. But it is going to be pretty interesting as we start looking at totals for that Easter period, Cassie, or from middle of next week over Easter, because it looks like it could be some pretty good falls through the south of the state.
Definitely keep an eye on that. Thanks so much for that, Vince.
No worries.
Vince Rollins from the Bureau of Meteorology. The far west of New South Wales is going to be partly cloudy tomorrow. Overnight, it's getting down to 11 to 15 degrees, but the daytime temperature is still quite in the pocket there, mid to high 20s. The lower western, partly cloudy. Overnight, down to 9 to 12 degrees, but again, rather nice. Daytime temperatures in the low to mid 20s as well. I've got more to come on the Country Hour as we approach 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, so glad you could join me. I'm Cassie Huff, if you're just joining the program. Now, the windmill, I think it's possibly among the most iconic sights you can see on a farm. Many people, perhaps people who aren't of the land, associate windmills with farms, but they're on the decline, with farmers now opting for solar panels over windmills, so much so that an historic Mount Gambier-based business has officially closed its doors from today.
It is sad in a way, but I suppose you've got to move with the times. These days, the old windmill just doesn't cut it. I mean, a lot of people seem to be running more and more cattle and they want more and more water. And with the windmill, you can only get a certain amount of water, whereas with the solar pump, you can come and say, well, I want, you know, so much water, and you can achieve it, whereas with the windmill, you can't.
I think we still have a windmill that is occasionally used, but have moved to pumps as well. As I'm saying, a lot of people have moved to solar pumps and things like that. But I'd be interested to know just how important windmills have been to you over the years, what they have delivered, why they might be iconic to your property or your family in some way, or perhaps if you're not off the land, perhaps you've got somewhere you like to see where there's windmills or what they may mean to you. You can text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. I'll get into that soon. And we'll head to the Corunda Farm Fair. It's on today and over the weekend, so we'll see what some of the highlights will be there. But first, here's the news, the news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, a grand jury has voted to indict the former US President Donald Trump on criminal charges after investigating payments made to former adult film star Stormy Daniels to buy her silence over an alleged affair. Mr. Trump has labelled the impending charges as political persecution and election interference at the highest level in history. State Liberal MP Nick McBride says he'll remain with the party for now rather than becoming an independent, but the rogue member has left open the possibility of moving to the crossbench if his ideas for the next election campaign are not taken on board. Audio of him leaked yesterday criticising his party's relations with industry groups. And the Cancer Council says it's pleased that melanoma rates among young South Australians appear to be dropping. Researchers found progressively fewer people under the age of 40 have been diagnosed with the deadly disease over the past 20 years. It also found cases are stabilising for 40 to 59-year-olds, despite rising in the oldest cohorts. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. Well, Corunda Farm Fair is on once again. It has been at reduced capacity, or not held in recent years due to COVID, but it's back at full steam this year. Football grounds at this Murraylands town are a hive of activity now. There's the yips of yard dogs, there's gasps at the giant pumpkins, and of course the buzzing of shears at this event, which is in the heart of sheep country. And Eliza Burlage has been taking in the sights. Hi, Eliza. Yes. So how are things going?
Oh, it's been a fantastic morning here, Cassie. We've been here from bright and early, just before 6 a.m, and people were here then just setting up their stalls. The sheep and the yard dogs arrived, and the trainers have been running their dogs through their paces, always a great sight. And apparently there's even school buses of students come up from Adelaide for the day. So people here from all across the state and the country.
So what are you actually checking out at the moment?
Oh, look, at the moment, I was drawn to, you know, big things. They do have a big merino here, even though it's one of the smaller big things. But I'm at the big or giant pumpkin competition at the moment, actually. So I didn't know that this pumpkin competition is judged by weight rather than the physical size of it. And so they've just got the scales already, and they've announced a winner. But, yeah, they definitely needed quite a few hands to lug those pumpkins on top of the scales.
Right, so they could do it with people? Because I've seen some competitions where they have to almost get in a tractor, they get so big.
Yes, oh, absolutely. No, they're a little bit more modest this year, Cass, I'm told, and I've had a chat so far with one of the organisers of this, which I might catch up with later. But yeah, she said that it was a bit harder this year because it was such a cooler year. Pumpkins just haven't been growing quite as big and quite as well. But look, I'm here with the winner. I've got, is it Darren here, who's won with his pumpkin. It was 28 kilos. Darren, how did you grow such a big pumpkin?
Oh, I don't know, just fertiliser and yeah, it was a good year and that's about it really. Wasn't much to it.
I'd heard from quite a few people it was a harder year for growing pumpkins. What's your secret?
Oh, I don't know, just get the seed in at the right time and yeah, that was about it really. Nothing major.
And are you a repeat entrant in this one or do you grow lots of other veggies as well?
No, this is my first year doing the big pumpkins and yeah, hopefully we'll get the giant sunflowers in for next year and yeah, that'll be good.
Now, I wonder with this pumpkin competition as well, we're saying, you know, the bigger ones aren't usually that good to eat. What will you do with 28 kilos of pumpkin now that you've won the competition and you've got your ribbon?
I don't know. I think the chooks might get a good feed anyway, but there might be a little bit of pumpkin soup, but yeah. Yep.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Darren, and congrats on the ribbon.
Thank you.
Looks very good. And I've got Janine Dutschke here. Janine Dutschke is the Vice President of Karoonda Farm Fair and Show. She's been very busy lugging these giant pumpkins onto the scales and judging the inaugural vegetable growing competition. Janine, what do you think of the quality of pumpkins this year?
I think it's actually fantastic considering the season we've had. It was really hard to get going. I reckon there was 10 or 15 contestants that couldn't even get their seeds up, so Darren, he has got all the clues, I think, so we need to interrogate him.
And how do you ensure the integrity of pumpkin judging? Because it's done, I understand, by weight, you know. And I was talking to someone before. Couldn't they sort of, you know, pump some metal or some concrete in to make them heavier?
Yeah, as we lift them, we hear if they're whishing or swishing, so we know that that's all good.
Very good to know. We definitely do not want any cheating in the pumpkin competition. And before I let you get back to it, because you've been very busy this morning, you know, I guess how is the show going so far?
Yeah, look, the crowds are building up. Fridays, you know, can be a bit of a quieter day, but we're looking for big things around lunchtime and tomorrow will be spectacular.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully we maybe get some pumpkin soup out of this because it's been a nice sunny day, but it is a little bit cool. So thank you so much, Janine.
No worries. Thank you.
It should be a great day here, Cass. So there's 2 days of the Karoonda Farm Fair and Show. Today is the first day here at Pioneer Park, but there'll be plenty on tonight. I understand the speed shearing is happening and there's plenty of activities tomorrow as well.
Well, I'll let you go and check that out, but sounds like a big win for Darren there with his big pumpkin. Thanks so much for letting us know how things are going, Eliza.
Thanks so much, Cass. I think he'll be dining off this win for a while. And it's cooked.
Literally and metaphorically. Thanks, Eliza. They're meant to taste horrible, though, those giant pumpkins. They're really sinewy, I believe. But anyway, it's still a great win. And if you're keen to check out Karoonda Farm Fair, it's on today and tomorrow at the Murraylands Town. So do check it out. Now to windmills. After 112 years, the last ever Varco windmills have been delivered, with farmers now opting for solar panels over windmills. Owners Dean and McCabe have called time on the historic Mount Gambier-based business, which will officially close its doors today. And I'd love to hear some of your memories about the difference windmills have made on your property. It was the only way to get water in some parts for many years. So text me 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. Retiring manager Kelvin Foote made the last ever Varco windmill himself. He says it'll be an adjustment after decades of being in the windmill business.
I've been working here for 22 years. I actually started just in the workshop, just as a factory hand, I suppose you call it, and then worked up to the supervisor of the workshop. Always been hands-on, always liked being hands-on, welding and all that. And then about 10, 11 years ago, I took over managing the place, and I was still hands-on, which I, you know, like doing. And, yeah, that's about it, really.
And what kind of change have you seen over that 20-odd years you've been working here?
Oh, when I first come here, there was three people in the office and three or four out in the workshop. And you just flat out all the time, whereas over the last 5 years it's just been a real downturn, and to a point where I work here on my own. I've got a bloke in the office for 4 hours a day and that's it. It's just changed the times, I suppose.
And how do you feel about the announcement of the business closing down?
Oh, well, I was retiring anyway. Like, I gave notice March last year, and with intentions, I thought they were going to bring someone in to take over, and then it didn't happen then. So it's just one of those things, I suppose. They put it on the market hoping someone would take it over, and no one took it over, so I suppose it's done what, you know, what they've got to do, I suppose.
And how do you feel about it closing down?
Oh, I'll be sad to see the business go. Like, it's been a good place to work, and Varco name's been around for a long time, but I suppose, like Leon said, it's just technology and you've got to move forward with it, and people aren't doing the windmill work anymore, so that's, you know, another reason. Everyone that used to do the work for us is no longer doing it, and so it's just, they've got to go with the times, I suppose.
And have you had much to do with the customers over the years?
Yeah, no, I deal with the customers. I do the quoting and stuff. And, all the customers are good. A lot of the customers now are getting a bit funny about it, saying, oh, where are we going to get our windmill parts and this and that? But unfortunately, after the 31st of March, there'll be no longer. So, you know, unless someone else takes the moulds and all that and starts manufacturing, I can't see, they can't do much about it.
How do you feel about people not using this technology as much anymore, you know, windmills? Is it sad that it's being phased out in a way?
It is sad in a way, but I suppose you've got to move with the times. These days, the old windmill just doesn't cut it. I mean, a lot of people seem to be running more and more cattle, and they want more and more water. And with the windmill, you can only get a certain amount of water, whereas with the solar pump, you can come and say, well, I want, you know, so much water, and you can achieve it, whereas with the windmill, you can't. So that's another factor in why the windmill, you know, isn't cutting it.
Is it fair to say you're only one of a handful that has still been making windmills? It's a pretty niche profession nowadays.
There's not many around now. Like, you've only got Bryan Brothers and, like I say, Southern Cross and that, but I think they're all feeling the same as us. They're not, you know, people say, oh, it'll turn around and people will come back to windmills, but I can't see it. You know, it's been a decline over the last 12 years. You can just see it just slowly declining, so I can't see them ever coming back.
Windmill maker Kelvin Foote. Varco Windmills chairman Leon Cutting has been involved with the business since 1979. He says while the closure has been a long time coming, it is still sad to be losing that local expertise and history.
We had most probably a peak of about 200, over 250 mills a year. 21, 22, we only manufactured 25. So, but in that time, the amount of solars that we've sold, that's most probably up to 40 to 50 a year, but there's not a lot of manufacturing there. The panels are bought in and made up by our employees and sold, but as far as the windmills are concerned, it's, you know, instead of being in trouble and running behind time with the manufacturer of them today, it's just not viable.
And so whenabouts was that peak of selling windmills, and how long has the decline been?
To tell you that. The peak was about in 2001-2002. That was when we were 250 odd windmills a year, and as I said, it's gone down to in the 20s last year. And in this financial year, I mean, we have sold a lot with the announcement of closing down, but up until that time it was only about a dozen mills that have been sold. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's technology.
So who have your customers traditionally been?
Oh, the man on the land. I mean, we've sold mills virtually throughout Australia, and there has been some exports. So most probably the big areas were the southeast, western Victoria and the Gippsland areas.
And have you been hearing much from your customers since the announcement? What have they had to say?
I think there's, especially with the old-timers, a lot of disappointment. A lot of history will go by the wayside, because once the clearing sale is done, there'll be no more parts. So, and the windmill's capable of being around for 100 years, with a little bit of maintenance and all that. So it'd be interesting to see whether the solars will last that time.
And how do you feel about the closure?
Most probably sad, because, I mean, I haven't been directly involved with it since Chapman's took it over, but I've been involved in the company. Yeah, just seen a lot of history, and that history is gone.
You said technology has been the main culprit for this. Do you think there should still be a place for the windmill on farms? Are you sad that you might not be seeing them around as much?
I suppose that's not my choice. That's the choice of the farmers. And they, you know, as Kelvin would be able to verify, that they're all looking to the solar, because it's for the windmills to go in today with occupation, health and safety, to put a tower up, to go up the tower and all this sort of thing, you've got to have certain equipment and all this, which a lot of the people that do the installations, they don't have. Whereas with the solars, well, there's no climbing or anything like that.
Do you think there might come a time where people will miss or regret the fact that you can't get windmills here anymore?
It's most probably like a lot of things, you know, the old vinyl LP and all that, that's on the way back and all these sort of things. Yeah, maybe in future people would say, well, maybe we need to revert. Future will tell.
Yeah, what goes around comes around. Dean and McCabe Chairman Leon Cutting speaking with Elsie Adamo. And if you do have any special windmill memories, let me know. Text 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891.
On digital and on mobile.
ABC South Australia and Broken Hill.
Wool is used in many of the clothes we wear these days, but have you ever seen a wedding dress made out of wool? There are around, but they're rare, and one very persistent South Australian bridal designer has been determined to take the fibre all the way to the altar, and as Landlines Kerry State discovered, her backyard provides plenty of inspiration.
At Adelaide Fashion Week, a rural woman is taking a bold step. In amongst the state's well-known couture names like Paolo Sebastian, designer Nikki Atkinson has launched a new bridal label, Horrocks Vale. And all of her wedding dresses are made out of wool.
It can be mixed with laces, it can be mixed with beading. You know, we can create some beautiful dresses and make them look like any other wedding dress, but it's wool.
As a kid, Nikki spent more time trying to get out of wool than into it.
I remember having a little pinafore when I was probably 7 or 8, and all I can remember is it was thick, heavy and scratchy and itchy, and I didn't like it.
But the designer, who grew up on a farm, does have some fond memories of the fibre.
I'd have to say when I first fell in love with wool was probably as a kid jumping in bales, you know, at shearing time and things like that, because it was fun. It was loads of fun. But as a fabric, yes, it was certainly fashion school that I absolutely fell in love with it then. It is better than any other fibre that I have worked with. It's better than silks, your rayons. It's just so much easier. It's pliable. It tends to want to drape well. It's easier to sew. It's just, yeah, I haven't found any other fibre like this.
Her passion for the fibre only intensified when she married a wool grower and moved to their sheep property in the Flinders Ranges.
Yeah, when I get the sheep off the hill here, I'll be up behind them then.
While Dallas Lines is happy to stick to growing the wool, he is excited to see his wife take the industry he loves in a new direction.
People say that's really nice. What's that made out of? It's wool. Really? And that might stir things up.
After running a bridal boutique in Adelaide for 8 years, these days Nikki runs her design business out of Port Augusta. But until recently, her dream to design the ultimate woolly outfit, which started 2 decades ago, remained out of reach.
When a girlfriend of mine was passionate about wool, came off of a wool merino property north of Broken Hill, and she wanted a wool wedding dress. We couldn't find ivory wool. We could find suiting fabrics. We could find other, you know, black, white, like navies, very general colours, but we just could not find ivory wool.
But last year, on a girls' trip to Melbourne, she stumbled across a wool supplier who made her day.
He had everything and I just fell in love then and there, and I just was so excited that I couldn't believe that this was something that happened, it's giving me goosebumps, something that happened 20 odd years ago and it was finally something that I'd found.
How does it feel?
Yeah, it feels really good actually.
Feels good?
Yeah.
And so began her quest to not just create glamorous gowns but also educate people on the versatility of wool across all seasons.
It's actually really breathable. It's, yeah, nice and light and
nice
soft.
And light, yeah.
When you say to people, yeah, I've got a wedding dress collection made out of wool, what's the reaction been so far?
It's good for winter. That'd be great for winter. And I say, no, not winter.
Are people ready for woolen wedding dresses?
I think they are. I think they are because the world's changing. So I think people are looking for sustainable, eco-friendly fabrics that work well, that break down. And this is one beautiful thing about the beautiful fibre is that it will go back into the ground to grow more grass, to grow more wool.
For more on Nikki Atkinson and another designer shaking up the wool industry, you can check out Landline this Sunday at 12:30 on ABC TV. She was speaking with Kerry State there. And Leslie has texted in to say that she had a pure wool wedding dress 50 years ago, and her anniversary, or their anniversary, I should say, is in 2 weeks. Leslie made the dress herself, and also my mother's of Vine pure wool dress as well, pure wool veiling as well as the dress. So that's wonderful. And yeah, I mean, wool's been around for a long time. I think they're just really trying to bring it to the fore in terms of couture. So thanks so much for your text, Leslie. That was lovely to hear. We'll head to the forest now. Plantation managers may soon be able to walk through large sections of forests to get a quicker overview of the progress, and that's all without leaving their office. A University of South Australia research project based in Mount Gambier is working to move large-scale plantations into virtual reality. PhD candidate Spencer O'Keefe is leading the project and says the outcomes could be a major breakthrough with how the industry is managed.
Data practices in forestry are pretty well established. The last sort of 100 years odd, things have been based on the same process of going out to a forest, measuring a subset of a forest plot, and then extrapolating out to the full scale to get an idea of what the whole forest looks like. But in the last couple of years, tools for remote sensing have become more viable for use in industry. So there's a growing interest in companies being able to do more precise analysis and get a better idea of what's actually going on in the forest. But the problem with getting a huge amount of data is you need to actually be able to analyze it and interact with it in a meaningful way. So my work is looking at using immersive analytics tools, which are virtual reality, augmented reality, and 3D environments, to actually interact with virtual subsets of the forest and gain better understanding of the inner workings of the forest than you can get out of traditional means.
Whereabouts up to in the project are you? How long will it go for, and what have you been doing so far?
Okay, so it's a 3-year project overall, and I'm just shy of a year in. So this has meant a lot of background research and running the literature, seeing where the sort of the state of the medium is, and then defining and documenting, and then kickstarting where I want to go from here. So at the moment, that's looking at going from the remote sense data to pure quality data, for just to sort of refine down to what's the components that's interesting to a forest manager. And then from this, the next set of projects are looking at how do you visualize and interact with this data? How do you hook this in with growth models so that you can see what the forest is going to look like in the future without having to wait 30 years? And then how do you actually integrate that with industry? So sub projects looking at things like, can you do tree thinning and tree selection remotely with an X-ray vision of the trees that would let you potentially see features that might otherwise be obfuscated out in the woods?
What kind of features?
So just by virtue of being able to see through a tree. Trees are great, but they block your vision, and so hidden faults or issues with the wood quality that might be further up the stem can be a bit harder to spot. So being able to have an algorithm that can go through and actually highlight the points of interest that you might miss if you're walking through the woods, you'd effectively make the process more efficient in the long run, which would affect everything related to the forest management, and you would do it in a way that is repeatable and adjustable and would give you a data set that would then let you jump back in time 20 years and understand why the decisions were made then.
So you've got some pretty cool tech on the table here. What have you been working with? What kind of tech have you been using, I guess, so far?
So there's two bits of tech primarily. One of the headsets I'm using is an augmented reality headset called a HoloLens 2. And what this does is it has effectively sunglass lenses with projectors above them. It works kind of the same way as a 3D movie. It projects a slightly different image on each eye that tricks your eyes into perceiving depth and what you end up seeing in front of you. It kind of looks like a hologram out of something like Star Trek or Star Wars. And it's kind of difficult to get your head around if you haven't actually used one, but effectively it lets you see objects that aren't really there and interact with objects that aren't really there. So I'm using this to place and analyse point cloud scans of forest plots from around Mount Gambier and actually be able to put a miniature virtualised version of the forest in front of someone and say, what do you think about exactly this, and point to it in space.
University of South Australia PhD candidate Spencer O'Keefe. Forestry industry has been very interested in the results of Mr. O'Keefe's project. 141 Forest Digital Twin Program Manager Michelle Balasso says the research could be a game changer for plantation management.
What Spencer's has been able to show us is that you can visualize these trees in the office, even in the forest, but bring that objectivity to the measurement that takes away the subjectivity of the operator that has to measure the tree, but also estimate diameters up the stem, forks, kinks, warps, and all those features that may decrease the quality of the final piece of wood. When it hit the mill door, is too late. So we need to understand those features before we start bucking the trees and even before we start cutting it. And that's what Spencer has been showing us. And this is a new step towards the precise level of forest management that we are aiming to go towards. And precision forestry has been around for quite a while, but mostly in theory. And this particular project is bringing it into practice, into the industry, and is exposing us to the expertise of the university at an unprecedented level.
So many potential uses for the technology. How much time do you reckon this kind of tech can save a company like 141?
Well, you assume a crew that will go out in the field that will take a 20-meter radius plot, so taking every single tree and measuring them manually can take any time between half an hour to an hour for a very skilled operator. We have now a technology that allows us to scan the forest and the canopy and does that in 10 minutes for the same plot. So we have a factor reduction, which is extremely important. But it's not only the time saving, it's the precision of the measurement that we're looking at. It's not just an economical evaluation, how much money are we saving on labor, but is, are we providing more safety for our people that don't have to walk into forests that may be full of hazards, that may need to drive 2 hours and a half to get to this plantation? And how much more precision in this data are we acquiring, and how much is that worth?
141 Forest Digital Twin Program Manager Michelle Balasso speaking with Elsie Adamo. And you can see what forestry in virtual reality actually looks like. You can go to abc.net.au/rural to take a look at that. Now, that's about all we have time for today on this program. But you may or may not know that the Country Hour goes for an hour. However, if you're listening in Adelaide, you don't actually hear that full hour when you're just listening to the radio. So if you get the ABC Listen app and you listen to the regional stations like North and West or Renmark, Riverland, I should say, or the Southeast, you can actually pick up the entire hour. So if you'd like to listen to more of what we do here on the Country Hour, listen on the ABC Listen app between 12 and 1. It's a great chance to catch up with what's happening across rural and regional South Australia. But Sonia Feldhoff joins me now with a lot more to come on your radio this afternoon.
Hi, Cass. And that's one of the real bonuses of the ABC Listen app, isn't it? That you can be completely flexible and autonomous in what you want to listen to. You can switch across all the offerings that the ABC has.
I love it. I can, because my family's from northern New South Wales, I will listen in to sometimes a program there if there's something on there that
to keep up
I'd
with
like
your old hometown. Yeah,
yeah, and when dad comes here, he puts it onto the rural report that's in his local area still to check out.
So you can completely across it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can tune into Triple J if you just feel like a bit of a music burst, or Double J or something like that. So you can be completely autonomous in the way you listen to things. I mean, obviously,
we want you to listen.
I would
to
love
show.
You to stay listening to the afternoon show for 3 hours, but you know, like I'm saying, I'm not forcing you.
Yeah, as long as it's ABC somewhere.
Hey, that's something you can do that's really new with these digital applications. And let's face it, digital is taking over in so many ways. I mean, if you've got a boat license, you can have that on your phone. Yesterday we heard about Medicare cards that now can be digitized as well, so you don't have to have the hard copy. But where does it leave photo ID? Usually with your driver's license, right? We were hearing yesterday on the Producers Challenge, this was raised with us, about are you required to have your hard copy driver's license, or because it is available on your phone, is that sufficient to
constitute
a photo ID?
To clubs using just the one on their phone.
But I know people who've gone to pick up, for instance, click and collect items, and if they don't have their driver's license with them, they're told they can't pick it up, or from Australia Post. that on the phone it's not enough. So at what point, and driving, if the police pull you over and you've got to show your license, is it okay on your phone? Or do you have to the actual physical hard copy card? We'll be having a look at that that question this afternoon on the program. And also, I want to know from you, there are lots of things that people do in their life. You may have some of these, Cassie. Do you always know why you do things, or do you just do them because that's the way you were taught and told to do things?
No. I actually often think, like, my brain is not connected to my body at this point. Like, why did I just do that?
Yeah, but things that you were told to do, like you know, when you're towing a car, a lot of people cross their chains. Do you know why you do it, or do you do it just because your dad told you to do it that
way? One that entertains me is that my husband always makes me dessert with the soup spoon, and I'm like, why are you using a soup spoon? He's like, what, doesn't matter, it's just a spoon. Anyway, that's coming up on your ABC local radio.
Can't remember the talkback number? Download the ABC Listen app and tap your local ABC radio station to call or message us direct from the app and join in the conversation. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.